military first approach risks post hoc justifying or reinforcing the logic of China's military modernization.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Security Dilemma, a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. I'm Patrick Carver Fox, joined by John Allen Gay, as we have a conversation about China's use of armed coercion with James Siebens of the Stimson Center. James leads the Defense Strategy and Planning Project within Stimson's Reimagining U.S. Grand Strategy program, and he's the editor of China's Use of Armed Coercion, a 2023 study on China's use of military and paramilitary forces. Our conversation covers the South China Sea and China's use of military operations other than war. Let's jump right into our conversation with James Siebens.
James, welcome to Security Dilemma. So we've heard a lot back in the day about Chinese moves in the South China Sea, especially like in the 2010s. I mean, like when I was in grad school, through the middle of that decade, everybody was talking about South China Sea. Here's this reef that they claim. Here's that thing that they're building. Is this going to be the next flashpoint, et cetera? Now it gets a lot less focus. I feel like you never hear it anymore almost. Everybody's talking about Taiwan. So one, what's up with this shift? And two, what is going on in the South China Sea vis-a-vis China nowadays?
Great question. And thanks for inviting me to join you for this discussion. So I think that the best answer for your question is that there's not a lot of exciting action in the South China Sea. So what China has primarily done is it's drawn a line around territories that it claims as its own, and it has started to conduct regular patrols, aerial and naval patrols, often led by the Coast Guard, in order to kind of demonstrate its ability to project military and paramilitary power out as far as the first island chain, basically. That demonstration of presence serves a couple different functions. On the one hand, China is attempting to protect its fishing fleets that are often operating inside the exclusive economic zones of other countries, or at least based on their claims. And it's worth noting that there are five other countries with competing claims in the South China Sea. So China doesn't have a dispute with one or two countries. There are five countries, including China, that are debating different features and who owns what. And so I think a lot of the coverage that you were referring to in kind of the 2010s and the mid-2010s especially had to do with China's unilateral build out of military installations on some of these formally disputed features, but features that are under China's de facto control. And so it engaged in a lot of kind of dredging and reclamation activity to allow it to build airfields. And it sent a lot of, missile batteries and radar installations out into the South China Sea to similarly demonstrate China's ability to project military power that far. And you could argue, as I do in the book, that a lot of what China is attempting to do there is simultaneously demonstrate to the other claimants that it is in possession of those islands and would be difficult to dislodge, and then also that the United States should feel less comfortable operating within China's missile ranges, basically. It is an effort to gradually and without much actual use of force kind of change the threat perceptions of its neighbors, competing claimants, and the United States in the South China Sea. Now, that has turned into kind of a status quo, and there's not a lot of action involved other than, like I mentioned, the protection of Chinese fishing fleets. And the flip side of that is the harassment and deterrence of other claimants' fishing fleets that are operating or seeking to operate within their own national exclusive economic zones, or EEZs, just to kind of save myself a breath in the future. And so it's this contest over who has the right to exploit the economic resources in the South China Sea. And China has effectively claimed that it has jurisdiction over those maritime areas, and it is engaged in kind of police actions or constabulary actions and patrols to demonstrate its ability to exercise jurisdiction.
I'm curious what China's goal is in terms of maintaining an international presence beyond the South China Sea. I mean, the South China Sea seems to be this hotbed of conflict and controversy. You got, you know, countries promising to ban the Barbie movie after something that looked like the nine-dash line appeared in a map. In your December policy memo, you state that China has not succeeded in compelling formal acceptance or recognition of its claims to exclusive or territorial rights in the Spratly Islands. Is international recognition or de facto control the real primary objective?
Yeah, it's a fair question, and I don't think it's either or. So the answer is both. It has already established its de facto control. So that part is no longer really in question. It's more of an effort now to get others to accept that control. And it's simultaneously, acceptance can come in multiple forms, right? One is de facto appreciation for Chinese presence and an understanding that, you know, efforts to fish in certain areas will likely result in some kind of harassment or interdiction by Chinese Coast Guard vessels. And so arguably there has been a kind of shift in behavior among some claimants, especially countries like Malaysia, to reduce the amount of friction in the relationship with China by kind of reducing the opportunities for China to harass their Coast Guard if they try to enforce their own economic rights in their EEZ, for example. So de facto control is definitely part of the picture, but China also is making these claims in a kind of legalistic way and is attempting to couch them in its interpretation of UNCLOS and its...
the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea.
Thank you. And its interpretation of its jurisdictional rights therein. And that comes up not only with respect to its purported jurisdiction in the South China Sea, but also its ability to restrict U.S. military surveillance within its exclusive economic zone.
China seems to react differently to efforts to demonstrate sovereignty from competing actors, reacting differently to the Philippines than Malaysia or another power. Why is that? What are the patterns that matter here?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought up the Philippines, because I think that the meaningful difference there is kind of how, you know, the specific issues that are being contested play out. So, for example, China has effectively occupied Scarborough Shoal with a maritime presence, and has at various times excluded Philippine fishing vessels from that area. And then when relations with the Philippines improve, then Philippine fishermen are back fishing near there and are not experiencing as much harassment. So there's kind of an issue linkage between the bilateral relationship and the treatment of the country's citizens, their ability to kind of engage in economic activity in these areas that are under de facto Chinese control. But the other thing to bear in mind with respect to the Philippines, because there is, you know, the most exciting thing that's happening in the South China Sea, arguably, is this crisis over, or a sort of a slow-moving crisis over Second Thomas Shoal. Now, this has made headlines recently, in part due to the Philippines engaging in a kind of strategy of exposing China's interdiction of its supply ships by bringing journalists on board its own vessels when it goes out so that they can take pictures and report what China is doing in response to these resupply missions. But that kind of thing has actually been going on for more than a decade now. And the issue is that the Philippines has a ship lodged on the Second Thomas Shoal and has maintained essentially a garrison there since the late 90s, since I think 1999. China asserts that it got the Philippines to agree to remove that ship eventually. Philippines now says no, they never made any such agreement. But China has not really tried to dislodge the ship, and it hasn't usually objected to efforts to resupply the garrison with kind of essential materials. What China's objecting to, and this is something that's not usually discussed in press coverage of this issue, they're objecting specifically to the Philippines building some kind of permanent structures on the shoal. And so shipments of building supplies to the shoal have been interdicted by China since 2013, at least. That's gone through a number of evolutions because the Philippines at one point stopped sending building supplies in 2013 and then resumed sending building supplies, construction materials, in 2014 after the U.S. Conducted kind of a political and military show of support for the Philippines' position on the shoal, that it has the right to do what it wants to on its territory. So China had never accepted the Philippines' right to kind of develop its position on Second Thomas Shoal. And that is the main source of its objection, is that the Philippines is really engaged in building there, which is a unilateral action in China's view that runs contrary to what China thinks it has agreed to with the Philippines about unilateral changes in these kind of contested territories.
To zoom out, if we're trying to create some sort of understanding of how China engages in the South China Sea today, what are the fundamental principles of China's use of armed coercion in the South China Sea? What should be the rules that policymakers are approaching when interpreting China's actions?
I guess the fundamental issue at stake is that China is asserting territorial claims on features that don't constitute territory under international law. And so it is asking other countries to behave as though it has formal territorial rights where there are no existing quote-unquote territories. Okay, so that's kind of one major source of friction. Similarly, China has a broader interpretation of its jurisdictional rights under UNCLOS, and it interprets the treaty as permitting it to regulate scientific activity conducted within its exclusive economic zone, which it says that's what, you know, U.S. naval surveillance and patrols, FONOPs, constitute, right? They either constitute military presence in its EEZ, which it says that it has the right to regulate and require advance notification for, or that it's conducting scientific research and it has the right to regulate that, or that other claimants are conducting economic activity and it has the right to regulate that. So again, this connects to China's interpretation of its jurisdictional rights and its assertion of broader territorial rights than international law would permit. Now, with respect to the military dimension that I just mentioned, China is not the only country in the area that has a similar interpretation of UNCLOS about its right to require advance notification for military activities conducted by foreign militaries within its EEZ. That is also kind of a sticking point occasionally in the U.S. relationship with India, for example, although it's generally preferred not to bring that up. But I mention it because I think it's important to know that, you know, China doesn't have a unique interpretation of UNCLOS in that regard.
You write that the primary challenge for the United States in countering China's coercive behavior in the Indo-Pacific is political rather than military, and that U.S. strategy should emphasize diplomacy, public information, and law enforcement, and avoid an overemphasis on military tools and tactics. What are the essential risks of using military tools and tactics as America's answer to Chinese armed coercion?
Yeah, so I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting that there is not a role for the U.S. military in managing this challenge. The point that I was making there is that a kind of military first approach risks sort of post hoc justifying or reinforcing the logic of China's military modernization and mobilization. So China often presents itself as kind of under siege or surrounded or subjected to a kind of U.S. containment strategy. The U.S. has allies along China's periphery and has military presence in those countries. And so China regards its kind of strategic imperative as developing the capabilities to defend itself against U.S. Military advantages and to be able to exercise its own kind of freedom of action in the region. So a military first approach to countering what I think is predominantly a kind of a low level persistent harassment problem, right? And a contestation of territories that are not U.S. territories, but are rather, you know, Southeast Asian friends, partners, allies, territories, would simultaneously increase China's threat perception from the United States and increase a kind of a political framing in which the United States is seeking to dominate the region and dominate China through increased presence and cooperation with countries along China's periphery. So I think that it's likely a better option to do kind of what the Philippines is doing and what the United States has been doing in support of the Philippines, which is to demonstrate our ability to cooperate and our support for the Philippines' legal rights and its efforts to exercise its own law enforcement jurisdiction within its EEZ. And this is done by joint patrols or the occasional U.S. overflight during sensitive confrontations with Chinese and Philippine forces, as well as training, assistance, and arms sales, essentially, increasing the Philippines' capacity to patrol effectively its own territorial and EEZ maritime space. Also increasing the Philippines' ability to, and I don't want to limit this to the Philippines, but I'll say increasing partner capacity to detect unwanted Chinese presence in their EEZs. Maritime domain awareness is the term of art for that. And then effectively respond to it. Now, this may increase friction between the partner countries and China. That's a predictable consequence of whatever approach the United States might take. But I think that it's better to allow partners to kind of take the lead in the enforcement of their own rights. And then, you know, in the case of our treaty allies, China is aware that territorial aggression for sure and attacks on our allies' forces that are exercising their own legal rights would sort of have implications for the mutual defense pacts. And so there are limits to how far I think China is willing to press U.S. treaty allies, especially over these issues. I think it's very unlikely that China seeks to, you know, land forces on Second Thomas Shoal, for example, right, and seize these features by force, as it did in the Paracel Islands in the 1970s. It dislodged Vietnamese forces from there and seized those islands, and they've been under Chinese control ever since. That was an armed conflict. That kind of action in the present moment, I think, would have unacceptable political consequences for China, and China is conscious of its reputational costs from that kind of naked aggression. So that's all to say that whatever approach the United States takes to assisting allies and partners in countering China's harassment, intimidation tactics should be in service of their ability to enforce their own rights rather than stepping in front of allies and partners to attempt to enforce their territorial rights for them, just because of the political message that risks handing to China for kind of information purposes.
So it sounds like China cares about their reputation within the region and that their actions are undermining their reputation in the region. I'm curious how we judge the South China Sea as an element in their reputation within Southeast Asia. You state that China's efforts have arguably led to increased resistance and balancing behavior, including greater military cooperation with Australia, Vietnam, Japan, and India. However, in each case, you're describing American cooperation with those countries. When we're judging the balancing response not incentivized by America, how much of that is about China's behavior in the region compared to the changing dynamics of China's military capabilities in general, the expansion of the PLA Navy, the expansion of their nuclear arsenal? How do we judge why people are balancing against China?
Yeah, like how much of it is because China is just more powerful than it used to be? And how much of it is that China is being more pushy than it used to be?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I think it's difficult to disentangle those two things. What I'll say is that, you know, similarly to what I just described about skepticism about China's intention to actually conduct international aggression against these kind of competing claimants over, you know, sand and rocks, I think China wants economic benefits, and it wants to have a recognition of its great power status. And so its bullying behavior is a kind of an impulse to create a hierarchical regional order. And that has essentially handed the United States a tremendous political advantage in the region because the much smaller countries on China's periphery are not only confronted with a China that is increasing its military capabilities in general, but also one that is demonstrating potential leading indicators of kind of aggressive and revisionist intentions. Something that government of China sometimes claims is that, you know, the United States goes too far in conflating capabilities with intention. And I think it is important to not totally conflate those things, right? The United States has the most powerful military on earth. Does that indicate an intention to conquer Asia? You know, maybe, maybe not. But let's not assume that it does necessarily. We have to look at other indicators. So China is, in its behavior, raising the perception of threat in the region. And that, I think, is motivating some of this cooperation that we've seen evolve over the last several years. Like, for example, since 2017, Indonesia and Malaysia and the Philippines have formally cooperated on joint maritime patrols. Also, since 2017, there has been a regular dialogue, the Quad dialogue or quadrilateral security dialogue involving the U.S., India, Australia, and Japan. And that has more recently pulled in South Korea, New Zealand, and Vietnam into some meetings under the auspices of Quad Plus, quote unquote. And then obviously the AUKUS cooperation security and technology between Australia and the UK and the United States have all kind of indicated increasing multilateral arrangements for improving security and military capabilities. I'll also mention that Vietnam and the United States formed or declared a quote unquote comprehensive strategic partnership last year, which, you know, Vietnam and China immediately upgraded their relationship following that, just to make sure it was clear that the United States wasn't supplanting China in any meaningful way with Vietnam, But closer cooperation and the potential for future cooperation with Vietnam, I think it was a sort of political signal to China from Vietnam that they aren't isolated. They do have other friends in the region and globally, and that China should not push them into the arms of others.
Looking north to Taiwan, how might Chinese coercion look there? Are the patterns going to be different? And also, like, what are some steps that they could take to escalate their level of coercive behavior toward Taiwan from where it is now?
Great question. I think that Taiwan is, fundamentally a different kind of issue in that China has described it as kind of the core of its interests. And, you know, when the United States established relations with China in 1979, it was at the forefront of those negotiations. And, you know, China repeatedly made reference to the fact that it was a fundamental issue for the normalization of relations. So in recent years, we've seen China conducting regular patrols around Taiwan, and they've drawn a 10th dash on the 9-dash line to make clear that they are including Taiwan as part of their military exercises, which tend to be conducted kind of in objection to different political moves they see on Taiwan or coming from the United States. They've essentially demonstrated their ability to project power east of Taiwan and kind of imposed some elements of a kind of mock blockade. And so I think the blockade scenario is the most likely escalatory move. And it's several notches up the escalation ladder, I think, from where we are today. The kinds of patrols or missile tests that they conduct sometimes for purposes of political demonstration are the most likely kind of predictable consequence of crossing certain red lines with China with respect to the U.S.-Taiwan relationship especially. And also, there are certain things that Taiwan shan't do without invoking China's anger, such as reforming their constitution or making a formal declaration of independence, just to name the two most prominent ones, perhaps. I think Chinese leaders have repeatedly rejected the idea that they would eschew the use of military force to advance unification with Taiwan. They say that they're still pursuing peaceful unification, but that kind of all options are on the table and they won't defer the issue indefinitely. So there is a very clear intention to unify with Taiwan in a way that's different from their intention with respect to Second Thomas Shoal, for example. And I think, you know, the lower levels of escalation that we might witness are things like broad cyber attacks. We've seen some of that happen already, especially in the wake of Speaker Pelosi's visit to the island. Disruption of undersea cables, for example, is another concern I would raise, that China's in a position to increase Taiwan's isolation by restricting its access to internet, let alone kind of vital resources like fuel. Taiwan is an island, and it is dependent upon imports for its economic livelihood. And so if China did decide to start to increase interdictions of shipping for purposes of imposing new regulations, for example, that might be short of a blockade, but would interfere in a meaningful way with Taiwan's ability to import goods that it needs.
So one of the views you'll hear about this potential conflict in Washington is that if the United States wants to deter a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, we need to show resolve in Ukraine by continuing to support Ukraine to the maximum. You know, that if the United States steps back from full-scale support for Ukraine, that that will send a signal to China that America's commitments or whatever are not reliable, and that therefore they're going to be more likely to take action against Taiwan, believing that the United States won't step in. What do you think about that? Is that an accurate characterization of how China thinks about the Taiwan issue, how they're looking at the Ukraine issue?
It's a difficult question. I think that in some respects, the question of demonstrating resolve is paramount for both China and the United States. Both countries seek to establish their kind of reputation for resolve over these key issues. And what makes Taiwan such a difficult issue for the relationship is that both sides are essentially trying to establish maximum resolve over the same place. And whether or not the United States' commitment to Ukraine in any way translates into a general evaluation of U.S. commitment to partners and allies is somewhat dubious. Ukraine is not a U.S. ally, but then again, neither is Taiwan. Both countries are significant security partners for the United States. And so in a comparison, maybe there are similarities there. But I think the most significant relationship between the Ukraine conflict and the Taiwan situation is that in China's view, the United States may be sufficiently distracted and kind of drained by the conflict in Ukraine that it creates a kind of window of opportunity in Taiwan. So that, I think, is a more pressing concern than any kind of issue over resolve. It's a question of capacity. Does the United States have the capacity to deter a Chinese invasion of Taiwan while supporting full-scale conventional war in Ukraine? And I think, you know, there are efforts underway to better mobilize the U.S. defense industrial base so that the answer to that question is less difficult to discern. But I don't think that the United States' decisions regarding Ukraine policy has any effect on China's resolve over Taiwan. It is purely a question of whether or not China sees an irresistible opportunity coming out of this present moment that they would accelerate plans to attack the island. And the other way to look at that is that China is growing impatient with the lack of engagement with Taiwan. And so there's a time factor there. Xi Jinping has made reference to not wanting to defer this issue to future generations. And then the third thing is, you know, increased U.S. defense cooperation with Taiwan or military assistance to Taiwan can have the opposite of the intended effect of deterrence. It may, in fact, motivate an accelerated timeline for China if they regard Taiwan as developing the kinds of military capabilities that could make a military threat less compelling for Taiwan's leaders. So in other words, China has sort of relied on its ability to occasionally threaten Taiwan through demonstrations of force. And if those demonstrations of force become less credible because Taiwan's own defense capabilities have improved so drastically over the last few years, China may feel that it's no longer sufficient to simply hold a large exercise, that it might need to do something more meaningful in order to get Taiwan's attention. So this again goes back to the point that you or the quote that you shared about the challenge being primarily political. I think that the prospects of a conflict over Taiwan have been managed through diplomacy since the establishment of relations between the U.S. and the PRC, and that the threat of an invasion of Taiwan has been kept manageably low through diplomacy and through a kind of a political sobriety on the part of U.S. leaders, that some actions will motivate China to behave more aggressively and so avoid taking those actions. I want to provide another example, which some people occasionally float. Why don't we just put U.S. forces on Taiwan in large numbers? Or why don't we just park, a fleet there? And in China's framework or lens of looking at Taiwan, that could well constitute what they would call a foreign invasion, which is one of the main issues that they have identified explicitly as potentially motivating a military option in Taiwan. So while it may be a perfectly normal calculation from the U.S. side to think, well, greater military presence increases deterrence, through the Chinese lens, that may actually decrease deterrence or rather motivate or compel a response. So that's just to flag yet another example of how kind of actions undertaken with the intention of increasing deterrence can have a kind of counterintuitive or counterproductive effect in practice.
A little bit like a security dilemma, if you will.
A little bit like that, yeah.
Yeah. So China, you've also written about how China's been getting into what in American doctrine has been called military operations other than war. So things like using the military to provide humanitarian assistance, to evacuate your nationals from a war zone, to fight drug smuggling, do peacekeeping, etc. What are they up to, China, in this domain?
Yeah. Well, so you just named several of the military operations other than war that are included in the kind of formal doctrine for that. What I want to add is that the military operations other than war framework provides a kind of legal justification for China's use of its armed forces in peacetime. And China has engaged in international peacekeeping operations, exercises with partners. It's increased its use of military diplomacy and, distant seas or far seas escort missions and counter-piracy, humanitarian and assistance and disaster relief. As a way of engaging in international politics effectively, right? So improving its cooperation with other countries, demonstrating goodwill. These are all the same reasons why the United States has engaged in these same kinds of activities. So I think China really has tried to learn from the United States experience in using its own military for purposes of advancing foreign policy goals and also advancing relations with other countries. It's trying to emulate some of those practices in its own right. So as you mentioned, the counter-piracy operations that China has participated in the Gulf of Aden are a way to show that China can be a contributor to international stability. Same with international peacekeeping operations where, the UN has lauded China's contributions to those missions, both in terms of funding and in terms of contributing troops directly. China's the largest contributor of troops to UN peacekeeping operations among the P5, the permanent five members of the UN Security Council. And it's also engaged in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief in places like Nepal, the Philippines, and Japan, as well as in Liberia and Sierra Leone. And it has evacuated civilians, its own especially, but also civilians from other countries, from places like Yemen and Libya, in the context of conflicts. So, you know, for a variety of reasons, I think China sees political value in conducting these kinds of operations. The other thing that I want to add, though, is that it has a kind of a dual purpose. So there's this political benefit, perhaps, that China's seeking, but there's also a potential benefit to conducting far seas operations because it gives the Chinese Navy a practical opportunity to kind of stretch its legs, so to speak, and to get better at logistics and sustainment that are important features of any kind of overseas military operation or any effort to project power. So it's the same for peacekeeping operations, right? They're maintaining forces in the field. And that is a rare thing for China because China has had this principled approach to non-interventionism. And UN peacekeeping operations are a rare exception where China feels there's sufficient international legitimacy and justification to deploy its armed forces in other countries. There's host state consent. There's UN Security Council resolutions supporting the decision. They're in those rare instances, conducting military operations abroad in full compliance with international law.
So you've talked a little bit about some of these potential benefits from using this military operations other than war framework. How big is that benefit? Is this like an incremental gain by China, or is it a transformational gain? You know, is this like the thing that's opening the door for them to be a truly global power? And is it going to like really enhance the long-term combat power of their military if they've got some of this logistical practice? Or is it more like, hey, yeah, you know, it's like doing an extra exercise every year or something like that?
I would characterize it more as incremental than transformative. China still does not have a kind of global network of overseas bases that it sustains or deploys forces to. It has some presence and it's attempting to establish more, but this is happening in kind of drips rather than in a flood of new overseas military presence. So it's proceeding slowly but steadily, I would say, in trying to establish some overseas military presence and practicing logistics and sustainment through these smaller missions. But none of its troop contributions are in the tens of thousands. These are smaller missions. So we're not talking about large forces in the field. With respect to the humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, non-combatant evacuation operations, those are things that are really essential for any major power, especially a country like China that has such broad overseas economic interests and civilian presence. So the scope of China's overseas investments and economic involvement in third countries necessitates its ability to protect those workers that it sends over to these other countries that are often in the developing world and often in places where political instability is a very real risk. And so if China were unable to extract its people when they come into harm's way, that would reduce interest and viability of some of these overseas projects that China clearly wants to continue to engage in. Another thing I'll mention about military operations other than war, which I should also say is often translated as non-war military activities when discussed in U.S. Department of Defense publications. Maybe that's just to differentiate it from erstwhile U.S. doctrine on military operations other than war. I don't know. In any case, it's the same sets of activities, and it is they tend to be the kinds of activities that you could characterize as crisis response. So these are often missions where you don't know that there's going to be an earthquake, and you have to have forces that are agile enough to respond to these kinds of contingencies on short notice, and to engage in rapid deployments to deal with whatever comes up. China has been a somewhat frequent victim of earthquakes itself, and so that has been a function of the PLA. And its ability to respond to any crisis scenario requires the same kind of muscle memory on rapid mobilization that can be practiced through military operations other than war.
I'd love to drill into a specific example of that, because you were talking about that sort of overseas economic integration and Chinese economic interests, where they have actually an international crisis that is hurting them economically that could include something like this, and that's the Houthi attacks in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. They have a pretty huge economic presence in East Africa, and I believe the cost of shipping for oil tankers going from the Middle East to China has risen by some insane amount. But nonetheless, it doesn't seem like China's doing all that much, even though they have done these anti-piracy operations in the Gulf of Aden before, and they have a support base in Djibouti. Why haven't they been more involved in this crisis and Operation Prosperity Guardian, and something that would seem to me like a clear example of a moment when China can assert its role in the world stage?
Yeah, well, I think the most important answer is that the Houthis have told the Chinese that they are not going to target their ships. Your points are well taken. In other words, that there is an economic cost to China, regardless of the whether or not their vessels are specifically targeted by the Houthis with these missile attacks. But I think it's also important to place that specific crisis in the political context in which it has occurred, which is the war in Gaza, and the fact that the Houthis are conducting these attacks ostensibly to apply coercive pressure on the rest of the world, but especially Israel. And so the main thing that China has adjusted to is shipping to and from Israel. But its other kind of global commercial traffic has been exempted from these missile and drone attacks, perhaps because of its position on the conflict in Gaza. It is explicitly not supporting Israel in this moment as much as the United States or the UK, for example. So it does not want to lend support to efforts to counter the Houthis in this moment, because they are not threatening China explicitly. And even though they're doing economic damage, I think China is not willing to make an issue out of it, given the context.
Well, James, we've gotten to talk about a lot, but I just have one more question for you, specifically in that sort of military operations other than war. Some of the students at our network have talked in the past about the idea of a Chinese military intervention in a Central Asian state, instead of going out to sea, going, into the kind of place where Russia isn't very likely to intervene and America is very limited in its ability to do anything, in particular, sort of Mongolian mineral deposits and IMF warning that Mongolian political instability could disrupt Chinese strategic mining projects. Am I crazy? Like, is this a real possibility that China could assert force in a place like Mongolia, or anti-terror stuff in Tajikistan, or otherwise prove the PLA's capabilities in a region of the world where America has either literally withdrawn from or never really been there to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's outlandish at all. You know, under the auspices of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, China conducts regular counterterrorism exercises with other countries in the SCO. And, you know, the evils that are being combated by the SCO in their framing include extremism and separatism. And so if there was an extremist threat, terrorist organization or Islamic extremists in a country that requested Chinese assistance in countering it, I don't know that China would object or would decline necessarily. It's context specific, though. And I think if you're talking about intervening in Mongolia against the wishes of the Mongolian government, that is much less plausible than a kind of a counterterrorism operation that's conducted in cooperation with the host government, especially under SCO auspices, because that is what the organization is ostensibly for, is to promote economic cooperation and also security cooperation to maintain mutual prosperity and so forth. So would China jump at the opportunity to deepen its security cooperation with countries in Central Asia? I would not be surprised in the least.
Awesome. Well, James Stevens, thank you so much for coming on Security Dilemma.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Security Dilemma is a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. To learn more about our programs, visit our website at jqas.org. Remember to rate and review in your podcast app and join us every Tuesday for new episodes of Security Dilemma.